Thank you for this possibility to share my views here. Neuroimaging and neurostimulation methods provide multiple windows to human brain function. And from those signals, we can extract multiple metrics for brain function, describe local effects, network effects. However, in order to functionally interpret these neuroimaging-derived effects, we need some sort of models. And we don't really have a model of the of brain function as a whole, as such, so we're focusing on domain-specific models. In language, the first models were built on based on acquired or developmental disorders in specific aspects of processing, with the idea that if some aspect is broken down and others still work more or less, then that aspect, that broken aspect, reflects a kind of distinct stage or module. And the resulting, these influential descriptive models of processing stages have been extremely useful in the study of using neuroimaging to study language. However, development of behavior-based quantitative models is very important to link with the already observed variation, quantitative variation in neuroimaging metrics. And more recently, there has been strong interest in building computational models of representations and mechanisms that would keep, could be linked with brain signals, in the hope that this could allow help us to really better understand how language is implemented in the brain. And in this talk, I hope to illustrate some of these approaches and advances. Now, in any, whenever one takes, has a new tool, just like neuroimaging was 20, 30 years ago, the first level of maturity is that one is able to really have, ensure that we have reproducible group level descriptions of processing stages. And this is what the neuroimaging community has done for the first couple of decades, very successfully indeed. And I would just like to illustrate a couple of this our current understanding of the cortical dynamics of language perception, just with a couple of examples. So here's a behavior-based model of word reading. When we see a word like familiar word like swan, the visual features are processed first before the analysis can proceed to the content, presumably first a level single letters, then as a whole word, which further activates the word's meaning and also possibly its sound form. And meaning is reached by about 200 milliseconds. In the brain, we can identify brain areas and time windows, especially in the left hemisphere, which seem to have salient, consistent roles in word reading. So at the back of the brain, the occipital midline, we have an activation about 100 milliseconds, which is just showing to all kinds of visual items. It's non-specific. But then at about 150 milliseconds in the left inferior supratemporal cortex, we typically see activation that seems to be sensitive to letter streams. It doesn't care if the stimulus is prelexical, doesn't care whether stimuli are words, non-words, entire consonant strings. But then the subsequent activation, sustained activation in the left superior temporal cortex between 200 and 600 milliseconds does differentiate between words and non-words. And this sustained activation seems to reflect processing of meaning, sound form, even syntax. If we hear spoken words, then behavior-based models suggest a sequence of something like this, where the speech enters the ear as sound waves from which the brain somehow extracts speech sound sequences, and eventually item meaning by about 200 to 300 milliseconds. Again, in the brain, there's the activation in the superior temporal cortex, and the time course looks something like this. So first, at about 100 milliseconds, there's a transient response to all kinds of auditory stimuli. If the stimulus is a word, then we also see this, it's followed by this kind of sustained activation, which reaches a maximum of about 300 to 400 milliseconds after the stimulus onset. Although this activation is largely originates in the same general cortical area, there are different processing stages reflected in this during this time course of activation at different times. So by 50, 100 milliseconds after stimulus onset, the signal shows sensitivity to speech-specific acoustic features. By about 150 milliseconds, the supratemporal cortex can differentiate between different sound speech sound categories, so different phonemes. And from about 200 milliseconds onwards, the signal shows sensitivity to word meaning. But we should keep in mind that the brain may tell a partly different story if we in more naturalistic conditions. So here's an example of natural language processing, where subjects were listening to their own speech, which had been recorded earlier, and to another person's speech, also noise, which had the same envelope as speech, and the stimuli had been produced at low, normal, and fast speech rates. So also here, this measure of modulation spectral power shows signals in the superior temporal cortex in the left hemisphere. But what the left hemisphere side seemed to be interested in was just the rate. So as soon as the rate deviated from the normal rate, then there was increased signal, presumably also increased neural engagement. But in the right hemisphere, the effects reflected processing of speech content and speech ownership. And this right temporal parietal junction is kind of an interesting area. It has been previously linked with attention and social cognition. And it's possible that its involvement here reflects a role in processing of communicative social relevant speech. But let's move forward to the next level, towards representations and mechanisms. So what we saw so far was something we call semantic activation reflecting semantic processing, whatever that is. But what about cortical representations of individual item meanings? So we also feel that there's some structure to that. So for example, dog, horse, cat, they're somehow related, they're all household animals. Boat, car, train, all vehicles somehow come together. Drill, saw, scissors are all tools we use with our hands to get stuff done. So how do our brains carry information about the qualities that form the item meanings and their relationships? And here language technology offers methods to model semantic relationships quantitatively by the contexts in which words appear in large text collections. And one of such tools or methods is its Word2Vec. When we have a text-based model, brain data, or we can use machine learning, we can try to learn the model feature, the brain patterns related to the model features. And then we can predict, try to predict the brain activation to any word, any item, and also then try to decode from the brain any item that the individual might have seen or heard. This approach was introduced by Tom Mitchell, and they showed many items to the participants, recorded the fMRI patterns to each of these items, and then they introduced this feature space in between. And Mitchell made the educated guess that the way that the brain organizes knowledge might be approximated by something like Word2Vec, method taking from language technology. And then they learned the relationships between the link, they learned, used machine learning to learn the correspondence between items, brain patterns, and the features of this feature space. And then after that, they could predict what an airplane might look like in the brain, what would be the fMRI activation, fMRI pattern, and decode from fMRI what the item might have been. And this type of approach generalizes to unseen items as well. Then the other approach is another popular approach for linking features, semantic and other types of features to brain patterns, which is representational similarity analysis. And here, Clark and Tyler used various types of features to build distance matrices among the items. And then they measured fMRI signals to each item. And then they built these different models that they tested. So they had a low level, so they built this similarity or distance matrices between the items. And this is a low level visual model and a semantic model, and then separate models for each semantic category. So for the animals, tools. In the brain, they went through the brain in small areas and checked whether the distances between items, dissimilarity matrices among the items, had kind of similar patterns along brain signals. And the correlations with the models were different in different areas. So for the visual model, there was the best correlation with posterior areas in the brain, visual areas, whereas for semantic features, the best correlation was found more anteriorly along the ventral stream. But now we can ask how relevant is it really to use something like language technology-based, corpus-based semantic relationships as a model of how the brain organizes, represents words. And here an essential test is to ask whether such models can also be used as model of abstract words, which do not have a, for which we do not have, no, we have don't have any sensory experience, but which only exist in language. And here we used many Finnish words, animals, body parts, buildings, human characters, like teacher, priest, king, nature, object, artifacts, and medium abstract and highly abstract words. And we built a statistical model of this similarity matrix, the statistical model based on the on corpus material using word to vec. And it turned out that this model was able to successfully decode concrete and abstract words from MEG. Well, then to interpret these findings, we also built a separate model based on a questionnaire, which only measured the simple question of how abstract the items were considered. And it turned out that the representational similarity analysis for the statistical model and the abstractness model, they showed notable spatiotemporal overlap, especially in the left hemisphere. And this suggests that word abstractness is largely an emergent property of the that arises from the statistical regularities of the way we use language. Another essential test for whether this type of approaches are, this corpus-based models are meaningful is whether we can predict activation for items that actually have never been shown to the participants, but which they only conjure in their mind. And here we used a childhood guessing game. So the participants saw three clues at every trial: has legs, has a thick skin, has a trunk, and they guessed elephant, or is a fruit, is peeled, monkeys eat it, banana. Now the question is, after these three clues have been shown, at that point, what does the brain activation reflect? Is it the target word, the content of the three clues, or possibly all features related to the target word that one would, in reproduction, one would associate with that item, beyond this very limited set of clues we give in the experiment? And here's the semantic space which we get from the word to vec. It's huge. It's like 300 dimension or something, typically. And here's a three-dimensional simple representation of that. And here the orange dot shows the semantic coordinate of the average of all the three clues. Blue is a semantic coordinate of the target word, and green is a semantic coordinate of all features, the wide selection of features we would associate with the item in general. And so the way we did this is we did train the model using all items except two, and then we validated it, the model with the remained left out items, and there were all the permutations. So here we have, on the left, we have fMRI voxel values for each trial. On the right, we have the semantic coordinates for each trial, which we computed with Word2Vec. And now we learn the relationship between fMRI patterns and the model features, the semantic coordinates. And then we take the two left out items. We have the fMRI values. Then we can compute the predicted semantic coordinates with this model. And then we see if they classify correctly to the original semantic coordinates. And this is where we implement all the different models for testing. And what we found consistently across individuals was that the prediction accuracy increased from just using as a modeling the final clue to the using all the three clues and the target word. But importantly, there was a significant improvement still when the model included all features that would be associated with these items in pre-production. So what we seem to have here is semantic completion from bits of information. So it really seems that these corpus-based models are reasonably good proxies of how we organize knowledge in the brain. But we can use this type of approaches to look at other things as well, as at mechanisms, for example. And as an example, I would like to share with you this question, this addressing an age-old question of whether there are different mechanisms that the brain uses for processing speech versus other natural sounds. And here we have image response to a spoken word like wheel, flute, and other signals recorded over the auditory cortex. There are various possible descriptions of acoustic features of sound, and the simplest one of them is obviously just the simple Fourier transform. And then there are more sophisticated versions like modulation transfer function that also describes spectral scales and temporal rates, has been very successfully used with fMRI. These are still stationary models, so if we have time-sensitive signal like MEG, we can't really make use of it, but we kind of have to lump it to a single value to relate it to these models. Spectrogram represents a time-sensitive model, which is still computationally feasible. So we use that. And we used a physiologically inspired dynamic model where we aim to reconstruct time frequency points in this spectrogram based on MEG data at a specific lag with respect to the unfolding sound. And then we tested these models, all these different models, on spoken words and corresponding environmental sounds. So in the case of, for example, spoken word huilu, the corresponding environmental sound would be a flute melody. And for the environmental sounds, we found that using the time information didn't improve the prediction accuracy. However, for spoken words, there was a huge improvement with the time-sensitive model. And the model was worked best at lag of about 150 milliseconds between the unfolding sound and the cortical signal. So it's really just tracking it closely in time. So it really seems that there's something special about the way that the brain chooses to process speech, presumably to enable instantaneous acoustic to linguistic transformation. But we'd also really want to move forward to even like more fully computational models, mainly so that we would be able to would have a description of what the type of the computation and transitions between different processing levels. And here's an example of just again word reading, And now looking in detail at where this visual feature, letter string, meaning stages actually come from. So how what they look like. When we have stimuli like words, pseudo-words, consonant strings, symbol strings, and words in noise. And these are different trials. So here we have the, so when we see at the processing at the level of visual features, it's really just, so the words in noise is a condition where we have real words, but it's so much visual noise that we really can't identify the words. So now in this case, for the visual features, it's really the words in noise which is set apart from the others. For the letter string stage, it's all the letter strings go together, and then symbol strings and words in noise are different, have lower signals. Whereas for this level of meaning processing, we have the words and pseudo words are set apart from consonant strings, symbol strings, and words in noise. And here is a convolutional neural network a model that Marianne van Vliet has constructed based on starting from a very successful visual recognition networks. And here he used as many as 10,000 words to ensure that the model wouldn't be able to have just like one unit for each word, which is kind of in a way too simple, but it would actually have to do some have sublexical representations. And in these, so what the layer activations looked like was this eventually. So it looks like the first three layers, they have a very similar pattern as what we saw for the processing, for the signal that we interpret as reflecting visual, processing of visual features. Whereas levels layers 6 and 7, they have a very similar behavior to what we saw, so this letter string activation. And the final layer, output of the final layer, is really reminiscent of this lexical activation. So I think for me, this type of approaches, they hold great promise. So if these kind of things start to really work, not only can it tell us about this just well, word reading in general in healthy individuals, but eventually could also tell us more about, hopefully, about what happens in development, what happens in disorders, what is the stage or transition or computation that is somehow behaving differently, I hope. But finally, as a final part of my talk, I would like to touch upon the very important question of individual variability. And as an example, I would like to use word meaning. So this is just a kind of regular N400 type of paradigm. Sentence, subject or sentences were rated one word at a time. The piano was out of tune, has an expected final word. Then you can have a plausible but unexpected word, like when the power went out, the house became quiet, when most people would feel in dark. Or you could have totally wrong ending, like the pizza was too hard to sing. And when we look at the responses to these final words at the group level, we can see this very neat graded response, strongest response to the semantically wrong ending, low, very weak response to the expected ending, and something in between for the plausible, semantically plausible condition. And this type of this graded response we take as a sign of semantic processing. But actually, if we look at examples of individual participants, yes, we do see this overall very similar, this overall same effect, but the exact timing and the size of the effect varies quite a lot between individuals. Furthermore, we may ask, how then, if we think about these item meanings, which we have been looking at, how variable is it to for us to reach item meanings? And here the approach we are currently working on is to ask, how long does the brain need to accumulate information, features, before it starts to know, it kind of closes on certain, it comes to the conclusion there's a certain item. And here the subjects were shown photos of items of different kinds of items, and then we have the use word to vec to compute the semantic coordinates. Then we have image response, where we test by keep adding information, so basically collecting more features by using a longer and longer time of the data from the beginning to link with the semantic vectors. And so what we do is we leave one item out, use all the others to build a model, a relationship between semantic coordinates and brain data. Then for this one item, we use this model to predict its semantic coordinate. Then we compare how similar it is to its actual word-to-vec-derived semantic vector. And what happens is that this similarity keeps increasing when we add more information, more longer time, until there's a certain point when, after that, when we keep adding information, it doesn't improve the similarity anymore. And we take this point as the point when we reach an item mean. And this point, time point, this mean plateau time, that varies surprisingly much between individuals, so that it varies from 440 to 620 milliseconds even. And while we don't understand this phenomenon too well yet, and we only have started digging into this neurobiological neurobiology of this individual variation, I find this truly intriguing. And we may, of course, then we should also ask the question of how individually unique is our global brain function. So where does this variation come from? Is there some sort of neurobiological kind of more general basis to it? And here's an 8-second interval of MEG data recorded over the left and right sensory motor cortex, over posterior visual areas, in a healthy subject who was sitting relaxed with the eyes closed. And the frequency spectra on the right show a very typical pattern with 10 hertz activity in the posterior areas, both 10 and 20 hertz activity between 10 and 20 hertz peaks over the sensory motor area. And it turns out, intriguingly, that this individual's threshold spectral patterns can be distinguished quite remarkably well. So we have applied Bayesian reduced rank regression on an MEG dataset of 100 sibling pairs. And we just simply computed power spectra on the MEG sensors. And our goal was then to find spatial spectral compositions or components that would maximally differentiate between the phenotypes, so different families. And on the right-hand side, we have a coordinate system spanned by two of such spatial spectral components, and they'll show individual subjects. And what we see is that when we have two measurements of the same individual, the dots are just really together, and siblings are also quite close to each other. And we found that individuals could be recognized with high accuracy across different tasks and recording sessions from only a few seconds of data. I think this is incredibly interesting and promising, and could be really useful in the study of open, like huge possibilities for studying individual healthy individuals and in patients. But of course, we need to understand what this means. Where does it come from? What is neurobiological basis? And this is something we are trying to work on now, and it's in any case, it's an important phenomenon. We have to understand where it comes from. But that's all I can kind of say at this moment, but more to come. So to conclude, I hope I have managed to convey three points, which I will share with you now. So corpus-based and neural network computational models hold great promise for interpreting language-related neural effects. But a thorough understanding of both models and neuroimaging signals is essential for informative functional interpretations. And finally, individual variation must be fully appreciated in next generation human neuroscience. And computational models, I hope, may help to understand its neurobiological underpinnings. And I would like to thank my many wonderful collaborators for their incredible contributions. And of course, you for your attention.